Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Lisa Alaferis, health editor with KQED News in San Francisco. I'm your moderator for tonight's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org. This program is generously underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. Tonight's discussion is the primary care crunch, anticipating the doctor shortage after Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act is designed to extend health insurance to more than 30 million Americans who currently lack coverage. Yet there's already a shortage of primary care physicians, and with millions of newly insured, the crunch is likely to get worse. All of this happens against a backdrop of decreasing numbers of medical school students graduating with plans to go into primary care. To address these challenging questions, we turn to our panel of three experts in the medical field. First, we have Dr. Bob Wiebe, Chief Medical Officer for Dignity Health, formerly Catholic Healthcare West. Dignity Health is the fifth largest hospital group in the country and the largest hospital system in California. Dr. Wiebe, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Next, we have Dr. Kevin Grumbach. Professor Grumbach is chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UC San Francisco and co-director of the UC San Francisco Center for Excellence in Primary Care. Dr. Grumbach, thank you for being here. And Patricia Knight, a lawyer and former registered nurse. She is the founder of Pacific Coast Health Advocacy, which helps people in the Bay Area navigate the healthcare system. Please join me in welcoming our panelists. So, Kevin Grumbach, I'd like to start with you. Can you help us set the stage so we're all talking about the same thing? What is meant by primary care, and why is it important?
The most important part to understand about primary care, it's about having somebody who cares for you as a whole person. What a shocking concept, right? But it's not about just your eyes or your heart or your joints. It's about having a part of the care system that starts by taking care of you as a whole person and comprehensively addressing most of your problems. And as part of that responsibility in primary care, it also means being available. It's your portal of entry into a very complicated health system. It's where you start, whether you have a stomach ache or a heart problem or you need preventive care or you have some stress with your family. It's the one place you can start and enter the system. So it's comprehensive, it's accessible. The third key function of primary care is continuity. It's a place where you can have a relationship over time. You don't just go there once, but it's a sense of somebody who works with you and knows you over time to help you with the health system. And then the final part of that, it's about coordination. It's about, in this increasingly complex world of healthcare, having somebody who can really help work with you if you need to get to a specialist, if you need home care services, if you've left the hospital, to put it all together in an integrated fashion. So primary care is the part of the healthcare system that addresses you comprehensively, in a longitudinal way, in an accessible way, and in an integrated way. And the type of people who do that, it's a little complicated because lots of different people play that role in the U.S. healthcare system. I'm a family doctor. So I take care of people, as we say, from womb to tomb. People of all ages is what family doctors do. You have some people like Bob, who's an adult internist who does adult primary care, meaning does general comprehensive primary care for adults. You have pediatricians. You have nurse practitioners as well as physicians. But it all comes down to those people all can play a critical role in the system if they're able to deal with you as a whole person and really provide integrated, longitudinal, accessible care and help you with your comprehensive health care needs.
Thank you. Bob Wiebe, without even looking ahead to January 1st, which is when the Affordable Care Act takes effect, when people who purchase insurance, are the newly insured, when their health insurance goes into effect, why is there a shortage of primary care doctors right now?
Sure. Well, first of all, I think the shortage is real. I think the estimates now that Currently, we're short, maybe across the country, 15, perhaps 20,000 primary care physicians. And as Lisa implied, I think that is likely to get worse as we go forward. There's several reasons for the shortage. I think first and foremost is the pay disparity between primary care physicians and other specialists. I saw a recent survey where I think the average starting salary for a primary care physician is around $200,000, $220,000. Pretty good income, but when you compare that to some of the other specialists, they can be two, even three times that amount. So if you're a medical student, you're coming out of school, you have substantial debt of $200,000-$300,000, it's not surprising that you might look to a specialty that pays more than perhaps primary care does. The second is the work environment for a primary care provider. Primary care often is a very hectic and sometimes it can be even a chaotic environment. There's lots to do, a lot of demands on the primary care physician's time, a lot of administrative and other documentation burden. So the clinic can be a very challenging environment. Now, it's a very rewarding profession, but also it can be a very frustrating one. And the third, which is somewhat related to the two, is the pipeline or the growth of new physicians into primary care is not what it needs to be. And again, in part, it's related to salary, in part because we don't always have the right mentors in our medical school to encourage the students to go into primary care. And I think as we start to address the shortage, and hopefully tonight we'll talk about some of the possible solutions to this, I think that's where we need to go as a healthcare system to address these issues.
Patricia Knight, you help people navigate the healthcare system, but we just heard Kevin Grumbach explain what primary care doctors do. So I think that people are under the impression that they would not need someone else to help them with that.
Well, in many circumstances, they don't, and in other circumstances, they do. And I see the role as a patient advocate as someone who's not working in competition with the primary care physician, but actually working with them and with the care system, the clinic system. The patient advocate can make the primary care physician's work easier by formulating questions, making sure that when they get out of that very short clinic appointment, the patient fully understands what's been said and their questions get answered. The advocate also dovetails somewhat what the primary care physician does in that keep track of tests and what's happened and what medications the patient is on so that when you go in for that visit, you're fully prepared and can facilitate, the advocate can facilitate the visit so that everyone gets the most out of it. So it's not a competition. It really is an enhancement.
Okay. Kevin Grumbach, you talked about, Bob Weeb, you talked about addressing the reasons for why this is, and I'd like to hear first also what kind of disparity we have in the state of California around availability of primary care doctors, because I'd be willing to bet most of the people in San Francisco, many people in this room have access to a primary care doctor, but that's much more challenging in other parts of the state. Is that right?
It is, Lisa. But I would start by acknowledging, I bet you there's people in this room who have a challenge finding the right primary care physician or nurse practitioner or physician assistant. So I actually think it's a ubiquitous problem because the health system, as Bob said, is so skewed towards investing in the high technology care, building more hospitals, and failing to really invest in the primary care infrastructure to help people stay well and keep them out of the hospital. Preferably rather than take care of them once they're in the hospital. That said, you know, we have more than twice as many primary care physicians per person in a place like San Francisco as you do in Fresno County or Kern County, or if you go down into the Inland Empire in Riverside, San Bernardino County area. So there's sort of a general backdrop of a lack of investment and support for primary care. I think people across the country struggling with finding access to great primary care, and when they do, as Bob said, making sure it works well. But it is doubly hard when you're there in Fireball in the Central Valley or you're there in a smaller town in San Bernardino County. And again, it's just been a lack of a sense of how do we make sure our healthcare system is oriented where the needs are? How do we start by addressing the basic issues patients need. And maybe the most important thing is to keep people well rather than just wait for them to get sick and treat them. How do we have teams of people working collaboratively, and how do we invest the resources that really can optimize the value for our public?
Now, Bob, one thing that's happened recently is UC Riverside just opened the first public medical school, first new public medical school in California in 40 years. And that's in the Inland Empire, where there's also a shortage of physicians. And how much is that one strand of helping to alleviate the shortage? Is just a straightforward of training more doctors?
Yeah, in many ways, you know, that's the beginning of the pipeline is the medical school. To the extent that we can increase the medical school enrollment, I think that's good. We've seen that across the country, and Kevin probably knows the statistics better than I, but I think over the last few years, enrollment has gone maybe from across the country 16,000 a year, maybe now up to 19,000. So we are having more enrollment in the medical school, which is great. We're also looking at other areas of California. I think Sacramento is looking at, creating the first for-profit medical school in the state. I don't know exactly when that may open. I know they're working on that, and they have investors lined up. But that's sort of the start. The next step in the journey is the training program. And we have to make sure that we have sufficient training slots for the primary care physicians, and most importantly, that we fill those slots. And I think that's been a challenge over the years, is to get the best and the brightest into primary care. And that's really key, because I think in the primary care programs, those that train and leave the program, I think over half, maybe two-thirds of those graduating residents will practice within a 50-mile radius. So if we can get the training programs in California, we can get those full, and the people stay, I think that would be great for the state.
Mm-hmm. Now, Patricia Knight, you have a background as an RN,
right.
And Kevin Grumbach has mentioned nurse practitioners helping to fill the gap. So first of all, can you explain what is meant by a nurse practitioner and how that might be another strand to help alleviate the shortage?
A nurse practitioner is one who has had advanced training, generally at the master's level, in becoming a practitioner in obstetrics or in family care, pediatrics, and they've had more extensive clinical experience, and they are allowed within protocols or within clinics to provide care to patients. Nurse practitioners are seen, as well as physician's assistants, as sort of a support to the lack of primary care physicians, because a nurse practitioner, say, working in a family health clinic, can handle many, many of the problems that come in and take care of them without ever having to involve a physician. Of course, this means that there has to be some relationship between the nurse practitioner and the physician, and everyone needs to know, a nurse practitioner needs to know what she or he doesn't know and when is the time to get a referral or to get some more support. But almost every article I have read about the shortage of primary care physicians is putting a lot of emphasis on, well, we're going to fill in some of the gaps with nurse practitioners, with physician's assistants, which is all very good, but that means you need to churn out more nurse practitioners. And I personally, this is a personal belief of mine, to be an effective nurse practitioner, you have to have had a fair amount of clinical experience. And so I am concerned as we go forward in relying on this that we will have maybe more nurse practitioners, but not necessarily nurse practitioners with sufficient clinical experience.
Kevin, you're nodding your head, Kevin.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I think, Lisa, because I think we need everybody
right.
playing it to their full skills, and, you know, there's just too much work to be done that we can sit here and, you know, kind of get into spats about who's the right person to do it. We need to deploy nurses, physicians, pharmacists, mental health personnel well in the team. There's so much work to be done. But it's back to what Bob was saying. I mean, it's like if you're pointing that spigot in the wrong direction, you can just up the volume and it's not going to get you the outcome you want. You know, the incentives are so much, whether you're coming out of nursing school, medical training, to go off where there's so much remuneration to do very specialized, very sort of acute care things. And it's the same with a nurse practitioner. I mean, they could go work in a hospital doing acute care and get paid more than being in a practice in a small town where they're needed to do general primary care work. So until we change the system, until we start to value the work of primary care and all the team members in it more, and still we invest in all the personnel, the facilities, the work that's being done, we're going to just wind up with the same very poor product that's misoriented. I always say, you don't get to nursing school, you don't get to medical school if you don't know how to add, right? And people are coming out, as Bob said, heavily in debt, and they're just going where the... And it's not because they're venal or, you know, selfish people. It's, you know, it's a big investment in education. So it's really, I think, the challenge for the audience, all this, how do we create a system that really shifts it away from an orientation where we're spending $2.5 trillion a year and have public health indicators that lag behind most developed nations and, frankly, put us in a par with many developing nations. If you look at our life expectancy, our infant mortality, a number we talked about, Lisa, which is your likelihood of having an amputation if you're a diabetic in the United States is twice as high as people in European nations. That's not because we don't have enough hospitals to do amputations or enough surgeons to do amputations. It's because we haven't invested in the nursing care, the health coaching, the support to how to control your diet, the fundamental primary care to keep that foot healthy, and so you don't wind in the hospital. So I think that's all our challenge. We need to change the system to emphasize primary care.
So there's this double-edged sword of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare,
right.
Is bringing so many more people into the fold, such a greater need. Is it also helping to realign those incentives? So, Bob Weeb, we talked about that, the diabetics who are coming to your hospital, I mean, I don't mean to sound crass, but that is an income stream for your hospital. It's you're not in the business of keeping people healthy. So what does the Affordable Care Act do to help to realign the incentives so that there's money to be made in avoiding that amputation in the first place?
Yeah, and I think the Affordable Care Act, and again, many of us refer to it as Obamacare, I think will be a big help. Often we get caught up in some of the issues related to the politics or a lot of discussion regarding cost. But if you look at the components of the Affordable Care Act, there's a lot there that's going to help primary care. I think the first that actually came a little bit before the Affordable Care Act, I think it was in the HITECH Act, is the use of technology and the encouragement of the electronic medical records or the electronic health records. Since that was passed and the financial incentives for hospitals and physicians are there, we've seen a dramatic increase in the use of the electronic health record. And I think that will help us provide primary care, and I think it will help us coordinate the care that Kevin talked about before. Also within the Affordable Care Act are the beginnings of changing how we are paid, how hospitals are paid, how physicians are paid. And that is really crucial. So we're seeing in the Affordable Care Act, and it's being followed by the private insurers as well, is instead of paying what we call fee for service, the more you do of something, the more you get paid. The transition,
so the more amputations you
the
do,
more amputations, the more people right. with pneumonia, the more people that need their appendix out. You know, that sort of...
Oh, both of them.
So historically, that's how healthcare has been provided in this country. And it's sort of generated a lot of utilization and led to some of the cost overruns that Kevin spoke about a little while ago. So now with the Affordable Care Act, there are different ways to be paid. There are sort of bundled payments where there's a lump sum for the entire episode of care, and the various physicians in the hospitals will split that. There is the population health funding, where you take a group of patients, and the hospitals and the doctors and the clinics agree to provide care differently to keep people healthy. Because people don't want health care. People want health. Mm-hmm. And that's what we in the hospital business or the clinic business, that's what we need to do. We need to provide health. And so the ACA will give us the financial incentives to provide care that way. And then if there's money saved, it's split between the payer, whether it's the federal government or an insurance company, and the people involved. So I think that's a couple ways where I think the ACA is going to be a big help to primary care.
And Kevin Grumbach, you're nodding. Now, you're also in this position of both working for a ginormous medical center and being a family practice physician. Mm-hmm. And we have a question from the audience. How can hospitals and or health systems work most effectively with primary care providers? How can they make primary care, how can they help to make primary care more efficient?
What a great question. I think it's following up on what Bob's along the lines. We need to start thinking of it as health systems, not just the hospital here, the doctor's office here, the nursing station here. And that's what you want. So you want hospitals to reinvent themselves as partners in a health system that's delivering comprehensive care. And we've used this term to describe primary care now, the medical home. I don't know if you've heard of that. Now what we're talking about is the medical neighborhood. So you want the hospital to be a good citizen in that medical neighborhood. And as Bob is saying, I am now starting to partner with either the UCSF Medical Center, or I also work at San Francisco General Hospital, where there's a sense, if we did a great job, help invest more of those residents. If they come in together, particularly as Bob says, let's say we had a payment to pay for the population we're responsible of, whether they're in the hospital or not. There's suddenly a different incentive. Now, the hospital, we can put our money together and say, let's invest more in the personnel in primary care that would keep somebody out of the hospital. And maybe it's good not to have those beds filled up in the hospital. But so you have to have the hospital partnering with the primary care system, the other part of the clinical system. You have to, as Bob says, is change the payment so that everybody can work together and use that money as wisely as possible, invest it where it's going to get the best outcome. So you're seeing this. You know, a system that does it well is Kaiser. Kaiser, I'm sure some of the folks here are listening, are Kaiser members, and that's Kaiser has a budget. And Kaiser has no incentive to put you in the hospital if you don't need to be there. And they've actually done a great job. They, frankly, pay quite well now for primary care and invest in a lot of the nurses, the pharmacists, to work on people's diabetes and asthma and things like that. So what you want to start seeing is places like the UCSF Medical Center, our county system. I think Bob and Dignity Health is starting to form these partnerships. How can we actually take on some of the Kaiser attributes? Of course, we all want to do it, you know, we want to do it even better than Kaiser and say we even have our distinctive blend, but certainly what Kaiser has done is create more of this sense of integrated care and the ability to put resources where they're going to probably get the most value.
I think the other issue, Kevin,
Patricia seems like she wants to.
And I'm thinking that they also need to look at some innovation in the way patients are seen. You know, there's one thing when you go in and you're well, and basically you're going in for a checkup. And maybe you don't need to see your primary care physician for that. You're just in there, you're going through your vital signs, checking your lab work, et cetera. That could be done by a nurse practitioner, a physician's assistant, and you get seen, and then if there's a problem, you get referred. And then the primary care physician has more than 15 minutes to see their client. And when you were talking about incentives and why people don't go into primary care, just from a consumer point of view, I find going to the primary care clinic or the internal medicine clinic not a very satisfying experience. I wait a long time to see my physician. Then she's rushed. We have 15 minutes, and we have to get through it, and she spends a lot of that time filling out forms, you know, to refer me on to someone else. And I think if I don't have, and then I've been in when I've been sick. And when I'm sick, then it's an entirely different experience. We're focused on my illness. We have specific plan. I come in, I go out, and it's taken care of. I can't imagine working in that system of every 15 minutes, I'm either shorting my patient or I know I'm running over, which means all my patients, it's accumulating 20 minutes, 25 minutes. It must be very frustrating, and I contrast that to when I take my clients to a specialty area such as neurosurgery where we may have to wait a little bit longer, but when we get in there, we have more time, there are fewer patients. It's just a different system. And so if I were in primary care, I would be very frustrated by, you know, they're not widgets. I can't deal with everyone in 15-minute segments.
I think you say it beautifully, Patricia, which is, and that's, I think, the challenge for us working in primary care. We got to totally redesign how we deliver care. So some of this is our fault, and probably a lot of you have been to the office where it's frustrating. The waits, you're not sensing your needs are met, and it's because we have not sort of been creative about how to come up with innovative ways of doing it. The models we're starting to work on are, for example, you know, a lot of preventive care probably doesn't need a physician or a nurse practitioner. I mean, that's something a patient who's well-educated, particularly now if you have access to your electronic medical record, and we can train some of our more of our basic personnel and assistant to say, yeah, you know, you're due for the mammogram? When would you like it? You need your colon cancer screening test? You know, let's go ahead. Dr. Grumbach, you know, it's clear you're due for that based on the protocol. You need your flu shot? Let's just do it. And instead of me having to sit there and figure out, are you due for your flu shot, I could then spend my time really focused on the more complex issues that you really want to talk to your doctor about. But this is our job, I think, in primary care and involved in partnering with patients, in the people working it across a team, is how do we change the product we're delivering so that that time you have with your clinician is really valuable and really well done, and we're much smarter about our new models of primary care.
So I'd like to return to, I mean, you introduced this idea, Patricia Knight, about nurse practitioners and the one concern you had about them, but I'd like to have a little bit of a fuller discussion about Kevin Grumbach. You ticked off nurse practitioners, optometrists, pharmacists, so on and so forth, all of them practicing to the top of their license. So there are bills in Sacramento to try to permit this to happen, and they are bitterly divisive and very deeply opposed by, among other players, the California Medical Association. So how do we... I mean, one description I've heard of a primary care office would be more of the primary care physician is more of a specialist who's called into these certain difficult cases which can be internally reviewed, referred right in the office, so the patient doesn't have to leave and make another appointment and come back. So, Kevin Grumbach, what needs to happen to allow some of these other health professionals...
Yeah. Yeah, I think...
What needs to happen politically?
Yeah, I think first it is, you know, in our practices, we have nurse practitioners who are managing their own sort of set of patients side by side with this. And I think everybody... So I think there has to be some sense of making sure people can perform at the level of their training and their skill. I think there are some regulatory encumbrances. But I think it's also... I don't think the goal of this is just so everybody then can go out and you can have 42 people each working completely independently. What you really want is teams. I mean, I think that's the name of the game now, is teamwork. So I'm sort of... I do think we have to... You know, there are some issues, regulatory, that are very politically fractious. But I think the real goal is this, is how do you say, gee, you know, there's a nurse, and how do we use that nurse's talents to the best of her or his ability? I think we are rethinking what exactly is the role of the physician on this team. I think we're also thinking, you know, the regulatory battles about what can a medical assistant do. In some regulations, they can't give a flu shot unless the doctor specifically, you know, hovers over their shoulder. So it's just across the board, I think we have to rethink how we have some regulatory frameworks that can allow everybody to play in a much more team-based system rather than just can everybody go out and, you know, sort of bill independently.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think traditionally, primary care, to use the sports metaphor, has been viewed as golf. You have a single individual who's very talented, doing the best that he or she can. But as Kevin said, now it's a team sport. It's football. And maybe the physician is the quarterback. Maybe the nurse practitioner is the quarterback. But it's got to be a team. And I think when it is a team, people will not view each other as a threat. And so you have the ophthalmologist and the optometrist. You have the primary care physician and the nurse practitioner. Sometimes these individuals view the other as a threat, and that just doesn't make a sense. There's so much to be done. There's so many people that need our help. We've got to move past that. And again, the politics sometimes can get in the way, but I think we as leaders in healthcare and all of you that are patients, you know, we've got to make it happen and work with our legislature to move on this.
So tell me what that looks like, just going to the patient level. I'm a patient. I come into an office. I see the nurse practitioner. What kinds of things is a nurse practitioner doing?
Yeah, if you look, someone did a study a few years ago that was in one of the journals. If you were a physician and you had an average group of, I think, 2,500 patients is usually what the typical primary care doctor will follow. So if you're a primary care physician, you have 2,500 patients. If you did everything you needed to do on these patients, all the recommended practices, your typical day would be 21 or 22 hours, which, of course, is not possible.
It's all the preventive, the chronic
care. It's all
care,
the preventive, the screening, the wellness checks, the education. So I think in the ideal medical home, when you first walk in there, you're greeted by the person in reception. You move very quickly into the patient room. And your nurse, besides doing vital signs, is doing some of the screening and some of the diabetic education if you have diabetes or the high blood pressure screening, doing that. And then the nurse practitioner is coming in and doing some of the routine care. And if you're one of the more complicated patients with multiple problems, then maybe that's where the physician spends his or her time. So in some ways, we'll sort of tier the patients into those that are very complex, and the physician will be spending most of his or her time with those. And the ones that have the chronic disease that are stable, the nurse practitioner or the physician assistant and the team will be behind it. But if you need a pharmacist, we would love to have a nutritionist. Mental health is a key issue.
Yeah,
so much of our illness is related to behaviors. And having someone on the team that's in mental health would just be phenomenal. And I think it's essential.
Yeah, I think we have had such a blind spot to mental health, what we're now referring to as behavioral health. I mean, this whole idea that the mind is over here and the body is over here, and that is a huge issue I think we're trying to address in primary care. There's a lot of ailments that really are misdiagnosed as a physical, I don't even want to use those terms, but it's really about depression, anxiety. There's a lot of chronic pain. These are sort of the ailments of our time that really we need a much broader team and a lot of expertise. And that's a lot of stuff that winds up in the hospital because we haven't acknowledged these are some mental health issues. We need to sort of address them. And the issue is a lot of people don't want to go to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. The stigma is still attached to that. And it's much more effective if you can bring those personnel into a place the patient knows, feels comfortable. And we found much more success when you integrate that model into the primary care medical home rather than have these separate mental health and non-mental health systems.
I think in terms of innovation, what Bob was describing of you come in, this person sees you in the room, then the next person comes into the room and sees you, and you stay in a room. And perhaps down line, maybe what we should be doing is, that we've talked a little bit about group appointments or classes. And so if you have a medical home and you come into this office, yes, your vital signs are checked and we take your current history, check your meds, all that sort of thing, which can be done very quickly. And then maybe you go to a class and there's a nurse practitioner in there and he or she is working with you about diabetes care or congestive heart failure or hypertension. And you work as a group, or there's a group, or you go in and you work with a group of practitioners that are in there, the mental health, the behaviorist, the nutritionist, everyone's there. And instead of seeing one person sort of in a silo, you have a group, and with all the specialties together, you're able to provide a broader scope of care in sort of a concentrated time. And I think it's just healthcare has just kind of marched along in a certain way, and it's not going to get better without sort of thinking outside the box and some of these innovations that are coming along. And
I think Patricia, that's a beautiful model, the sort of group visits. The other thing is don't even come in at all. I mean, how many of you are able to communicate online now with your clinician? I mean, I don't actually need to see you. You can tell me what your blood pressure is and we can communicate virtually if it's time to adjust the dose of your medication or tell me how your sugar levels are and we can deal with your diabetes issues. So again, that should be the expectation is, but the issue for all of these, whether it's can I deal with you remotely, online, or even by the telephone, can we do a group visit where it's not a physician or even a nurse, maybe it's a health counselor, is that going to get paid? And right now, in too many of your health plans, I would not get paid for managing your hypertension online. I would only get paid if you come in to see me and I can then say, I will now bill for a visit.
Or if the patient has a stroke.
Right, yeah, and that tends to get paid for. And the same thing, a group, if you come see me and I run the group, I'll get paid. If you come into the office and it is a health counselor who's not a technically licensed a certain way, that won't get paid by most health plans. So this is where I think the consumer has to start to really challenge, how do I want to get my care and how do I make sure my health plan is paying for the services in a way that makes sure I get care where I want it, how I want it, in a way that's convenient to me with the type of people that are going to be best for my health care.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight's discussion is the primary care crunch, anticipating the doctor shortage after Obamacare. The program is underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. Our panelists are Dr. Bob Wiebe, Chief Medical Officer for Dignity Health, the largest health system in California, Dr. Kevin Grumbach, Professor and Chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UCSF and Co-Director of the UCSF Center for Excellence in Primary Care, and Patricia Knight, Founder of Pacific Coast Health Advocacy, which helps patients navigate the healthcare system. I'm Lisa Alaferis, Health Editor for KQED News in San Francisco, and your moderator for tonight's program. So I have a couple of interesting questions here from the audience, and the first one is, I am currently applying to medical school. What would you say to encourage me to go into a career in primary care? And I'm hoping that after all you've heard tonight that you're not dissuaded, but Bob Wiebe, why don't you give it a shot?
Sure. I think the good news is that these changes that are occurring in primary care are going to be very attractive to the new medical students. There was a brief opinion article in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think it was just this week. It was written by three medical students, and they were talking about how they really wanted to get in primary care, and they were aspiring leaders in primary care. And they were talking about some of the changes that we've been discussing tonight. And they had a wonderful quote there in it. It says, "The revolution has begun, and primary care now is becoming interesting again." And I think that is a great quote and shows the optimism out there among our new medical students. So we need to sort of nurture that in the medical schools with great mentors. You know, we all select our specialty for a variety of reasons. You know, money is certainly a factor, but there are a lot of other issues. Maybe we had an illness ourselves or maybe someone in our family. But often it's really that mentor at the medical school that just captures your passion and your imagination. And because of him or her, you want to emulate them and go in there. So we also need to back that up with great mentors along with these changes in the healthcare system that we've been talking about tonight.
Yeah. And then a second question here is, why does the quote-unquote medical establishment make it so difficult to license foreign medical doctors to attempt to practice here? Kevin Grumbach?
Well, So I have to explain then how the licensing works, I think. So in order to get a license in the United States to practice medicine as a MD, you actually have to train in what's called residency training. So that's what comes after medical school. So that's your specialty training as a family doctor, as an internal medicine physician, as a surgeon, anesthesiologist. Those are the residency programs where you have to first have your medical degree from medical school. So even if you went to medical school outside the United States and had spent 3, 4, 5 years in residency training abroad, you can't get credit for that. And other than very exceptional circumstances to come and get a license in the United States, you have to come and do your residency training. And then there's just competition. So there is any graduate of a school outside the United States that's an accredited school that has qualified through the initial licensing exam process can compete for a training position in the U.S. residency program. So, you know, some people say that's a reasonable approach. Other people say, well, that's, you know, why can't we just have well-trained physicians? I think there have been some questions about the brain drain, people call it, that people train often at public schools abroad, particularly if it's in a developing country, and then have the opportunity to move here. And is that, you know, stewardship? Why aren't we training more of our own physicians instead of relying on that? Other people say that's people's human right to go practice where they want to practice. So it's probably a less contentious issue than it used to be.
And then I also was interested, this was reflecting back to, you were discussing mental health, and but this is, there's also the question of this comment from the audience cites, and I will leave it to you experts to tell me how accurate this is that 50 to 60% of health is due to individual choices. What levers can providers most effectively pull to encourage healthy behavior and patient responsibility or accountability for their health? Patricia Knight.
Ooh. Well, I don't know about the statistic, you know, 50 to 60%, but obviously in many circumstances, behaviors do impact health. And if you have hypertension and they tell you to reduce your salt intake and try some meditation, et cetera, that should be something that you want to do. We all know, though, if you have a bad habit, how difficult it is to change a habit. I think the medical home approach could help. When you just go into your doctor and, you know, you're sitting there and the doctor takes the glasses off and looks at you and says, it would really help if you'd lose 30 pounds. And you have 4 more minutes in the office to talk about this. Yeah. And you are 50 years old and you've been trying to lose that 30 pounds for the past 30 years. Right. Well, the likelihood that you're going to go out and go on a diet is not as great as you're going to go out and buy a cookie, you know, just because you just are. But if you had a medical home, or you had some class, or you had someone who could check in with you on behavior modification, it's a long, correcting your bad habits, or not even bad habits, just habits to promote health, takes a lot of effort. And most people can't do that just on their own, and just because the doctor tried to scare them with, you know, if you don't lose 30 pounds, you're going to whatever. You need support. Those habits didn't come overnight. And then you have the extra added anxiety and guilt of, I need to lose 30 pounds. I can't. I'm a terrible patient. So you need another approach to it. And I think that some sort of group behavior, stress management, whatever is necessary for that particular problem, is essential if you're going to change and get healthy habits.
And what's interesting to me is that's a primary care issue, right?
Yes.
The needing to lose weight or perhaps quit smoking, these are primary care issues, yep. But they don't, what you just described would not need to be dealt with by a primary care physician. In fact, it's going to be better dealt with in other ways.
Right, but unfortunately, in most of the models, it is the physician or maybe the nurse practitioner, it doesn't matter in that 15-minute period, who gives you the bad news. Mm-hmm. And then you go out.
But this comes back to this need to transform the system.
Totally, and that's why we're starting to use health coaches. Again, these are vocationally trained people that usually often have the language skills, the literacy skills. They're from the same communities. That's who's much better about giving the message. I mean, it actually helps to have the doctor actually tell somebody, you know, I think it really is time to quit smoking if you're ready. And then to have that reinforced by a whole team that can then really spend the time to figure out the strategies. I mean, the other point I'd make, Lisa, I agree with Patricia's comments just 100%. But it's also, I do my clinical practice mostly at San Francisco General in our family health center. And all sorts of folks with what you would describe as lifestyle issues. But, you know, a lot of them are from more disadvantaged communities. Try to find fresh produce if you live in the Bayview District or Visitation Valley. You know, talk about your smoking when this has been your way of coping with unemployment and, you know, physical abuse, sexual abuse growing up and things like that. So I think a lot of it is getting out of blaming the victim and thinking the other thing we have to do is not only support people in primary care, we need to engage much more at the public health side about how do we create healthy environments, how do we build parks that are livable or, you know, usable, how do we encourage bike lanes not just to get to Twitter but to get to neighborhoods, you know, where actually the problems are much more compelling. So I think that's the other shift in is to not think this is all happening in the office, and that this is all medical care or nursing care, that a lot of this is how do we actually push primary care to work much more with our public health departments, with our community groups, to really address problems at the root, which is really the social circumstance of physical environment.
Well, now that's an interesting counterpoint to this other question from the audience. Is there a need to reset the expectations of the public? So I think this would be the perhaps more well-heeled public, okay, to deliver. So is there a need to reset the expectations of the public to deliver the care, the team care that you describe? So do people, when they come in, are they expecting way too much from the medical interaction?
No, I mean, I think we need our patients to have very high expectations and hold us accountable.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, certainly we're seeing this with a lot of our younger patients who, you know, have grown up in the internet era, and you know, they expect the convenience. They don't want to come into the clinic, as Kevin said. You know, they want to do it by text, or they want to do it by email, or maybe even by video conference. We're seeing more and more care being provided by video conference. So I think the patient expectations need to be very high. And again, it's up to us to meet their needs, not for them to accommodate the broken system that we currently have in place.
I agree very much with Bob. I think the question we are facing, because we're testing these new models, the kind of things Patricia's describing, Bob's describing, it is a question whether the public will get my care. It's a team of people. And again, you still want your personal caregiver, whether it's your beloved nurse practitioner or a family doctor. But the sense of, you know, it's okay. I actually don't need that person to be the one to actually order the mammogram. What I really want to do is talk about either, you know, once I've been diagnosed with a breast cancer, that's what I want to spend the time. So it's whether, or it's no matter what, you know, it's not okay if I have a cold and I just want somebody to tell me, is this a strep throat or is it something else? But if every time you come in you say, oh, I have to see the doctor, or even I have to see the nurse practitioner. So I think that's a little bit of the question for the public. Are they ready to know, yeah, there's that person there that I can trust that is my personal caregiver, but they are part of this team that's working really well together, and that's what I really care about, is to make sure this team is addressing my needs.
I think the key to have that engaged patient is crucial. Yeah. So we have to give the patients those new skills, because, you know, in the old days, we would order a mammogram. Why can't the patient, once she knows she needs that mammogram, order that directly? And so we need to give the patients the skills and the opportunities to help take care of themselves. It's got to be not just a team effort between the healthcare providers, but also a team effort and a partnership with the patients.
Yeah, and I think the healthcare providers, I don't really care whether I see a primary care physician. Maybe I'm at a stage in my life where I don't have many health problems, but when I have the flu, when I have whatever, I want to be able to get care. And at a certain stage in my life, the community team approach isn't essential to me. But if I move along in a different stage of my life and I have more illness or I have more problems, then yes, my primary care or that team becomes important to me. I also think that as we move forward into this new era, that patients should certainly have high expectations of the health care they get. But I think they also need, I advocate, taking some responsibility for yourself, being prepared to the extent that you can be for your medical appointment. And I don't mean searching out 10 different sites on the web page with, you know, many questions for your doctor. But having a sense, there are some very reliable sites online, and you can get a sort of an overview of a condition, and that enables you to go in and maybe ask more questions. Be prepared. Be ready to interact with your team and maybe take someone along with you so that there's some support for you. But I think patients are going to have to be more involved. And technology will help that. Like if you can be at home online and filling out a questionnaire before you go in for the visit, then that you can do that in the comfort of your home. And when you get there, the doctor or the nurse practitioner or whomever already has the information and you're not wasting time doing that. They have a document to work from. So I think it's going to be a two-way street, but I certainly would not lower expectations.
Mm-hmm. I think I was thinking more, when I read the question, I was thinking more of, I was conversely thinking of the patients who go into the doctor and want the silver bullet for whatever is ailing them. And that is, I think, a separate...
We're looking for it still.
We find it.
Yes.
What kinds of things you've talked about, the transformation that is going on, but what's going to help, Bob Weeb, what's going to help drive that forward? I mean, the Affordable Care Act has incentives lined up, but what other kinds of things are going to drive that forward? Where are we going to be in a few years?
Yeah, I think the main driver is economic. I mean, we spend one out of every $6 in this country is spent on healthcare. And I can't recall the source, but across my email today came a new study looking at the health quality of the United States. Kevin referenced this before. At least in this study I saw today, we ranked 46th of all the countries in the world in terms of our health outcomes. And we spend more than twice per capita of any other country. So that is going to drive it. The employers are no longer going to stand for, you know, double-digit increases in their health care costs each year. Patients are no longer going to stand for the increases in the deductibles and the co-payments. We just, as a country, can't afford to have this much of the economy tied up into a single sector. So I think the economic push is going to drive it. But then I think it's going to be the rising expectations of our patients, of all of us, to hold the system accountable to meet our needs. We often talk about patient-centered care, where care that is focused on what the patient needs instead of what's convenient for us. And I think Patricia did a nice job about describing how that would look in a room where you come into the room and everybody comes around you. I know somebody that recently was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she went into the clinic. It was a UCSF clinic. And within that one visit in one room, this individual saw the surgeon. She saw the medical oncologist. She saw a radiologist because she needed an imaging study. She saw a genetic counselor to see if she had some genetic risk for a recurrence of breast cancer. She was having some difficulty with the diagnosis, as you would understand, and she met a counselor. So six or seven professionals came to her in that one room in the course of the visit. And that's what I think people want and people expect, and we need to do our best to try to provide that, not just in the specialty care, but in primary care.
I think the other thing that I found interesting in preparing for tonight is the regular marketplace is going to find some solutions. Will they be the best solutions or forever? But Walgreens, CVS, they're starting healthcare clinics. And it's more than just getting your vaccines. It's some screening. It's some basic medical care. Target, Walmart, they're starting clinics, or they're connecting with other medical centers. Will this be successful? Will it be good? I don't know. But the one thing that the private sector does is they put an emphasis on customer service and competition, and maybe we'll, in the healthcare system, learn something from these experiments. Because, again, if people have high deductibles, for instance, and they just need to get a physical for their kid, this form filled out, and they can go to their Walgreens clinic and get it for $39 on sale in September, and it's effective, that is going to put some other kind of pressure on the healthcare system to say, okay, not that you do it for $39, but you begin to look at what does the customer want, what does the customer need. And I don't know, I don't think that we've seen as much of a private commercial inroad into provision of health care.
I think we'll see
like
more.
I think we are. And some of it may end up being very innovative that we haven't even thought about. But to me, that's a major change.
Yeah, we often call them the disruptors.
Yeah.
Think of what Apple Computer did to the recording industry with the advent of iTunes. So often when an industry is slow to respond, there will be those from outside the industry that will come in and do the change. And again, Patricia mentioned the clinics in Walmart and the pharmacy company. So again, I think we'll see more of that. And again, I think that's good for us because that will push us in ways that we haven't been pushed
before. It's always this tension about innovation and the market. It's interesting though. Which systems have really transformed in primary care? Again, I think Kaiser has done a very good job. Mm-hmm. Bob, we were talking before that Bob had worked in the Veterans Administration system. The VA has really transformed its care, and that actually came because it was an edict from Washington Central saying, we will have a primary care-based VA system, and it happens. Ontario in Canada, under their single-payer system, said, boy, we need to totally retool primary care. And the province did it. They increased the pay considerably under their system, and they designed that everybody now has to work in care teams into a much more integrated model. So that is one of the questions in the United States. Why, when you look around the country, the world, most countries have a much more primary care-based system, and a lot of it is because they're sort of planned. People say, what's the rational way to operate a healthcare system? And we seem to have find all sorts of ways of avoiding kind of just saying, there are better and worse ways. Why don't we just, as a nation, accept there are some better ways and say we should really support primary care and just be done with it? So
yeah.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You've all mentioned technology and video conferencing. We have specific questions about telemedicine, which I think is related to video conferencing. And how would telemedicine fit into primary care? How can it help to alleviate or expand the reach of primary care doctors? Bob Weed.
Well, Kevin mentioned the VA system. They have a very elaborate telehealth system. And the benefits, I think, can be local. So rather than coming into the clinic, If it could be done over video conferencing, that saves a trip. And we saw this with the downturn in the economy a few years ago. People were afraid to come to the clinic because if they left their job, they might lose their job. And so that started it more and more, this sort of virtual visits, whether it be by phone or by email or by video. The other area I think it really has the great potential is in those underserved areas that Kevin mentioned earlier. We get to some of the rural parts of California where there are not the complement of primary care doctors or even specialists. Having that telehealth is a great way to provide that care and get it out to areas that otherwise would go without. There's some technical issues and some licensing issues that have to be dealt with, but most of those I think we're getting better and better at. But I think this is a wonderful way. You can even now go for an emergency department visit. You can go online. There are companies now, these disruptors, that will allow you to have an emergency department visit online. Pay a flat fee. You'll see a board-certified emergency physician, and he or she will address your problem. Now, it makes me a little nervous. I used to work in emergency
departments. It's a little hard to stop the bleeding. Through the, you know, they have a special apparatus that you put on the telemedicine. Apply the pressure here.
Where's that pain? Yeah.
You know how to sew? You know how to sew?
Not appropriate for everyone. Yeah, right. But for the right patient population, I think it's a great adjunct.
Yeah. So looking ahead 10 years from now, okay, we're going to have... It's going to take 30 million people are eligible for it, will become eligible for insurance on January 1st nationwide. Not all 30 million are going to sign up at once. It's going to take several years. So, but 10 years down, the goal is to have captured most of those people. And take us into the future. What's primary care going to look like then? From the Medicaid expansion through to employer-based health insurance, Medicare, and beyond.
Yeah, Lisa, I think we're at this very transformative moment of healthcare, and Obamacare is really a symbol as much as anything. I mean, it will do some important things, and particularly it will assure that more people in this country get healthcare coverage, which is just uncivilized the way we've been approaching it. But it's beyond that is a sense of, as part of this coverage, we need to fundamentally rethink how we deliver healthcare in this country. And that's the statistics Bob gave you. It does not make sense to just cover more people and for the same shoddy product. I hate to say it. But that, you know, we can't cover more people with the idea that it's just and therefore $3 trillion, twice as much as every other country, and that the population doesn't seem any healthier. And people aren't satisfied because they can't get access to care or don't have a sense that we're being cared for as, again, a whole person. And somebody really is approaching us in a pension-centered way. So that's the real transformation. All the clamor politically, you know, all the states that aren't going to expand their Medicaid program, it's all the politics around coverage and financing. But there's this current underneath this that I think every hospital, every clinician in this country, every physician, every nurse is facing is we have to fundamentally rethink the model of care, not just how we pay for it, but what is the way we organize ourselves to deliver care. And I think that's where the public has to be part of that. You know, Bob mentioned patient-centered care. That can't just be lip service. I mean, everybody in this nation needs to say, how do we want our care to look? How do we want to get care? And I think it is part of a culture shift. If you're saying, what is the shift? It's partly that we're going to get away from, you know, that why is it that the only prime kind show on TV, you know, medical, it's always ER, right? I'm longing, honestly, I want to turn on the TV and see that show FP, Family Physician. And it's that, you know, gripping story of, you know, taking care of somebody with arthritis and diabetes.
Marcus Welby.
Yeah. So, but there was before, you know, maybe the future's a past. Marcus Welby, anybody old enough to remember that he was sort of a general practitioner. But I think that's where we're going to have to rethink our public sense of what is it that achieves good health for us? Not just consumption of health care. So we're all going to have to be partners in saying it's a lot about chronic care. It's not just how many more hospitals we can build in San Francisco. It's how can we invest much more in the primary care, in the teams, and value that. So I think that's what I would like to see 10 years from now, is that we still have great hospitals, we still have great surgeons, we still have great subspecialists, but we will become known as the city, the state, the nation, with the best, most sophisticated primary care where patients are engaged with nurses, physicians, other caregivers in how to keep themselves healthy as much as possible, how to address their chronic care way and become active people in partnering with their own care, and then when they need it, can get really, you know, excellent acute care. And I think that that's a shocking thing. You could do all that, you know that? Have better health outcomes, have better experience of patients, and spend a lot less than we're spending today if you just, but you have to challenge the interest, because a lot of people are doing very well, thank you, by the way the system is structured. You know?
Patricia Knight, are you worried that Kevin's vision might put you out of business?
No. I think it's a great vision. And, you know, I think what's sort of sad is I think back to when I was in school, which was a long time ago, and we were talking about prevention. You know, the best way to avoid illness is prevention and education and training. And here we are many, many years later. And I do think that's the solution. And somehow we've gotten skewed in our view. I think going forward, there'll always be, you know, hopefully the majority of people are healthy and just need a tune-up from now and then. But then every once in a while, something comes along and it's really critical. And as much as I'd like to see this, like to think that we're going to get to this great center, people are still going to need support. And so I don't think that I will go out of business, but I do hope that I would have a more collaborative relationship with the physicians, and that it wouldn't be a threat or why do you have to have an advocate? You've got us. And maybe it's really...
Or the system says, or your role becomes, that's part of what good healthcare should be about. I mean,
yeah.
I think that is more than just the physician nurse. I mean, that there is a role for patient advocates, health coaches. I mean, maybe we should start seeing that as not the exceptional thing.
But that the need, rule.
Yeah. But that's part of an extended team.
And Bob, you're the chief medical officer of a hospital system, are you? But you have this background in the VA. So how are you, from your kind of double vantage point, looking at the changes coming?
Well, there's always going to be need for hospitals. I think as we go forward, the role of the hospital will change. And again, as we focus more on health and we're able to do more and more in the outpatient setting, I think we'll see a different use of hospitals. I think we'll see a greater percentage of the hospital beds either be monitored or for intensive care. And I think we'll see a greater number of the beds used for either long-term care or for rehabilitation. And I think sort of that middle area now where we place someone in the hospital for antibiotics because they have pneumonia, that'll be done at home. And that's part of patient-centered care, and that's part of the technology and part of the new delivery models that will be available. So I think there's always going to be hospitals. I think hopefully there'll be fewer hospitals as we go forward. That's going to take at least 10 years to get there, but I think that's the direction we're moving. The only other quick thing I would add to the great description from Kevin and Patricia, as I look ahead 10 years, I think the big change that I'm hoping for is we talk now about the team and the doctor or the nurse practitioner being in charge of that team. 10 years from now, each of us will be in charge of our own health care. And I think that patient empowerment is really where we need to go, and I think we're moving in that direction. The Internet provides a wealth of information, some of it really good, some of it not so good. But I think the technologies will be there, and I think the systems will be there to allow each of us to be in charge of our own care. And I think when we get to that point, I think then really we have achieved that vision of what I would see as primary care.
All right. Thank you. So our thanks to the California Wellness Foundation for underwriting this program, and to our panelists, Dr. Bob Weed, Chief Medical Officer for Dignity Health, a national hospital system, Dr. Kevin Grumbach, Professor and Chair at the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UCSF, and co-director of the UC San Francisco Center for Excellence in Primary Care, and Patricia Knight, founder of Pacific Coast Health Advocacy, which helps patients navigate the healthcare system. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Lisa Alaferis with KQED News, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.